Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Anusha Kellyan and I'm joined by my colleagues Stephen Bush, Alva Ray and Patrick Maguire to look back on Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. Alva interviews the Labour leadership candidate Rebecca Long-Bailey and then you ask us, will there be a government of national unity?
So, Jeremy Corbyn gave his last Prime Minister's questions, which although his leadership has a couple of days left to run, in many ways marks the kind of formal end of the Corbyn era. So as well as looking forward to this terrifying world in which we can't go out more than once and police drones are shaming people on Twitter for walking their dogs, I think we should look back on the Corbyn era. Anoush, you and I are, accelerating towards the grave at an alarming rate. Well, what are your feelings when you look back on these 5 years that we've had?
Wow. Okay. That's a big question. I guess the person, and I know that I've angered many a New Statesman podcast listener and reader by saying this quite a few times over the years, the person that I blame the most for what happened to the Labour Party is not necessarily Jeremy Corbyn, but Ed Miliband. And I still think that when I look back on what's happened because of the way that he ran that campaign in 2015, which no one was really expecting it apart from you, of course, Stephen, when you wrote your Is Labour Losing piece just before the election. No one was expecting there to be a majority for David Cameron's Tory party in that election, really. And it was
actually,
Ed Miliband.
I did also think that Nick Clegg would end up back in coalition with David Cameron. So
but that is what a lot of people thought would happen. And indeed, that's what they thought would happen potentially as well. So it was really Ed Miliband's, I think, his very poor leadership and his weak campaign that kind of put Labour into this position, particularly as he was the person when running for leadership himself who was criticising New Labour's record and sort of trying to turn a page on that very successful period of the party's history. And that kind of opened the floodgates for even more, even more of a big break from the past, which I think really paved the way for Jeremy Corbyn's victory and what's happened with the party since, which is a sort of splintering, a official sort of rejection of its triumphant years and just all of this bitterness, which has in a way, strangely and ironically, led to a leadership election where, like we said on the previous podcast earlier this week, the overriding messages from the front runner have sounded quite Miliband-esque. And that worries me in terms of the next election, whenever that may be. I know that answer doesn't say very much about Corbyn himself, but I think that's kind of the arc that the party's been on. And electorally, it's not a very promising one.
So I don't really know why I thought that question would cheer us all up. But I did, and it hasn't. Yeah, I mean, it's odd because I guess the thing I'm kind of struggling with when I look back over the 5 years, right, is that the 2019 general election was both, well, I mean, as we said on the podcast the week after it happened, was not, I think, a surprise to any of us in terms of what we were hearing out and about in the country. Not a surprise in terms of, on the morning of September, whatever it was, 2015. The 2019 result was very much what I expected would be the result of the 2020 election. So I guess I'm still more interested in the 2017 election, simply because although in the run-up to the 2017 election, it became very clear that the election was not going to play out the way than we'd expected. I guess I'm still more interested in it purely because I feel aware that, I guess my anxiety is than a number of us, I don't think that you were doing that just then, but a number of people have kind of essentially, because the 2019 election sort of delivered the result they expected, it's kind of like they can go like, oh, well, we don't really need to worry about, like, because we basically have a situation where we've had two elections and at least one of them was clearly quite weird. And I realise I still don't know which one I think was the weirder election.
It's really difficult to know, isn't it? Because there was so much certainty after the 2017 election that we'd not we as in us on this podcast necessarily, but, you know, some of the Corbyn sceptics who were the most vocal were saying they'd underestimated Corbyn's ability and they were happy with the position that he'd got the party back into electorally, and he'd inspired all of these young people reportedly to go out and vote for the Labour Party, and he'd inspired all these new members to join, which he certainly did. And there was sort of this certainty there that actually, okay, maybe it's not so bad after all. And that's matched by the certainty after the 2019 election result that, oh God, it was actually awful and we were right all along. And I just think that kind of knee-jerk response to whatever the electorate delivers is quite dangerous, because like you say, neither really tell us particularly what will happen next time. But of course, the thing that both of those elections have in common is that Labour lost and its disparate coalition is continuing to splinter and drift further away from each other. So I guess unless something really changes in terms of its offer to both of those groups, then I think they'll continue losing.
Yeah, I mean, Alva, so you kind of came in for the really bad bit right at the end. What mm-hmm. do you kind of, yeah, what are your sort of feelings when you kind of look back on the Corbyn era?
I suppose it's difficult to distinguish what you think with your political analysis hat on and your own experience of it, because I began the Corbyn era at university at a very lefty college, and I remember the hope and promise of the early Corbyn days. But then since starting here, and also, you know, in the interim period, but especially, you know, being at the most recent Labour conference and observing up close all of the infighting and bitterness, and to be quite honest, like all the anti-Semitism right outside the conference centre, I think I kind of divide it into two things. I mean, I think that this sounds very twee, and I feel like you, like maybe the three of you wouldn't agree, but I think that there have been some very positive things about the Corbyn project, and lots of people will look back on his leadership as proof that there is sort of appetite for a kind of moral socialism and a really deep commitment to equality and a firm anti-austerity message and people who are really sincere and unslick and that kind of thing. And I think that prevails. It's just unfortunately wedded with this horrible feeling of bitterness within the Labour Party, really bad internal management, the scourge of anti-Semitism. And I think that, like, that's the Corbyn legacy. There's the positive side of the coin and the uglier side.
Yeah, I would have to disagree with one aspect of your analysis, which is that this was an era unique, especially in Labour politics, in terms of, as you put it, unslick operators who were, you know, sincere in their moral worldview, etc., etc. John Prescott was unslick and sincere in his left-wing politics. Mo Molan wasn't, you know, by any means a polished conventional central casting media performer. Peter Shaw, for instance, you know, it's sort of, I guess maybe this, and Corbyn skeptics would say this is part of the problem, right? I mean, there, and this is something that will dog the Labour Party forever. It will add another strand of a factional debate, which is the sort of year zero in 2015 approach to analysis of Labour history is going to be something any future leader will have to reckon with. And Keir Starmer is about to find out that is very difficult. And that also goes for key players on the left of the party as well. You know, if you would say to Ian Lavery, you know, have you always been a Corbynite? Ian Lavery would say, absolutely, I was a Corbynite before the term was coined. He'd say, well, yes, Ian, you remember the campaign group in the 2010 Parliament, but you also nominated Andy Burnham for the leadership. It's really tricky, you know, not to to pick on the other. It just made me think about how tricky it will be. And I suppose this, you know, history within political parties is naturally contested along factional lines. But because this has been such a fundamental breach for so many people, it's going to be really, really bitter, as you say.
I think so. I guess I broadly agree with what one sort of close Corbyn ally once described as the necessary course correction than it represented. I think the problem I always have is I kind of think that the Labour establishment or Labour's, you know, organised Corbyn sceptics, whatever you call them, very much deserved what happened to them in 2015. And then through failing to heed that message, deserved what happened to them in 2016. I just kind of regret that the rest of us had to live through it as well. You know, this kind of sort of like this incredible kind of we oppose the cuts, but we'll have to keep them. You know, this kind of inability to kind of go, you know, to actually do what every successful Labour leader done, which is like, you know, start with your values and win consent for them rather than kind of sort of this sort of like weird, completely rootless triangulation. And then the kind of arrogance and delusion that people lapsed into in terms of explaining the defeat and why it happened, you know, the internal defeat and why it happened. And I think that, you know, although I remain of the view that all three of the candidates to replace him have flaws, to put it mildly, I think that one of the ways that this, and I guess I also agree with Anoush, right, then, you know, the central problem of Labour politics, which I guess hasn't gone away and has been made worse because of the rancour, is that, you know, the thing I'm finding most aggravating is all of these people who were wrong about Ed Miliband, but who, because they were eventually right about Jeremy Corbyn, are running around talking about how you win, despite having never been involved in a winning election campaign in their life, having failed to predict defeat in 2015, failed to predict a hung parliament in 2017, are kind of just like, ah, well, now I'm a winner.
It's like when you see Ian Murray's campaign for the deputy leadership, no shade to Ian Murray, who has actually won. He has actually won something repeated times, which is the constituency of Edinburgh South, which he's won four times, and good for him. But talking when you see someone like Ian Murray, okay, they're from that political tradition within the party that historically has done a lot of winning, you know, on a platform that was originally set out in 1994 and then adapted over the course of three elections over the succeeding decade. But to hear people like Ian Murray saying we need to get back to winning, it's like, yes, but you haven't been doing very much of that at all. Apart from, you know, your bit of Edinburgh, ever. So what do you mean? As you say, Steve, it's sort of that sort of shtick is quite tedious.
Yeah, I think they have to figure out a way if they want to carry on with what your profile, Patrick, you say are Keir Starmer's true principles. If they want to carry on campaigning on those principles, which are very similar to those of both Ed Miliband and Jeremy Corbyn, then they have to find a way of talking about poverty and talking about inequality that doesn't either switch people off or put people off. And actually there's a lot of work being done, I won't go on about it, but there's a lot of work being done by anti-poverty and anti-inequality campaigners and academics into what kind of language makes those themes chime with the general public. And if the Labour Party would be open to listening to some of that research that's been done, then maybe there's a way of talking about these things and campaigning on these things that actually speaks to people in a way that can make the party electorally successful again.
So that's the interesting question for Keir Starmer, because something he doesn't have in common with Jeremy Corbyn, and indeed to pick up on something you just said, Anoush, but to pick up on something Alva said earlier, is that both have the tendency to speak in moral absolutes. You know, Jeremy Corbyn, you know, his aides used to joke that he has one stump speech, and I followed him on the road for a bit in the summer of 2018, and he gave it again and again and again, which was sort of, it's fundamentally a meditation on good things, you know, the NHS, Nye Bevan, primary school in Liverpool where every child gets their own musical instruments. Apparently that's his favourite piece of public policy ever. And then bad things, you know, the Tories, the right-wing media, etc., etc. Where, you know, Keir Starmer is obviously a better performer, I was going to say orator then, I wouldn't perhaps go that far, but he's a much better speaker, he's a much more accomplished media performer, but he too speaks in the language of moral absolutes. And whether that is, you know, as I write in the next issue of New Statesman, I mean, that is comes from a place of sincere conviction. But you do wonder actually whether Jeremy Corbyn has set down a marker that his successors will be compelled to meet. But maybe that sort of language of moral absolutes and you know, it is not the best way to talk about these things in an electoral sense. And it's quite depressing to say that out loud, but it's the consideration any political party, certainly one fighting from the left and hoping to win elections, has to make.
I think that's such a good point, Anoush, that you make about all the research that is being done on how you communicate particular political messages well. And it reminded me of of your piece that you did, I can't even remember when it was, but within the past few months, about how people define wealth and what constitutes an elite, and about how actually, because people see even quite extreme levels of wealth as within the realms of possibility for themselves and their own lives, they don't want to act too punitively towards people with much higher wealth. So yeah, I thought that that report, I've thought about it a lot. It's really stuck with me. We should re-promote it on the NS website. But I thought that there were lots of takeaways there for how the Labour Party can move forward if it wants to convert more people to its worldview, rather than, as you and Patrick were saying, a sort of a moralizing speech that only speaks to the converted already.
That report's by Loughborough University, so just in case anyone's not seen it, it's really interesting. But that's only in, that report was only for respondents in London, and there is more research currently going on by the sort of heroic focus group organisers in this current climate for Tax Justice UK on the whole of the country and how that, what their attitudes towards wealth is. And the respondents in these surveys and focus groups are all people of different income groups, so it's really interesting.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So Rebecca Long-Bailey, thank you very much for joining us on the New Statesman podcast today.
It's a pleasure.
So you're joining us from Salford, I gather?
I am, yes.
Obviously, these are different circumstances to be recording a podcast. We would normally have, you know, had you into the studio to speak to all four of the people who normally do the podcast, and we would have been talking about your Labour leadership pitch. But with this crisis that we're in at the moment, it's a little bit different. And so I actually wanted to start by asking you about your perspective as an MP mainly, because I know sort of anecdotally that lots of MPs are finding being the point of contact for a lot of people in their constituencies very overwhelming at the moment. Like, you're the person who hears about all of the difficulties that so many people in their community are facing, whereas those of us who are stuck at home only hear secondhand from the news. So I was wondering, what's your experience of how people in Salford are responding to this so far, and what kind of problems are cropping up that you see?
Well, it's an incredibly worrying time for everyone across Salford and across the whole of the United Kingdom. No, none of us ever thought we'd ever be in a position like we are today. And certainly as a constituency MP, I mean, we have been overwhelmed with queries and concerns and pleas for help from all sorts of different sources, really. So we'll start with the economic ones. So we've had a number of people contacting us who run small businesses and large businesses who haven't been sure of what support has been available to them. The government announced a business interruption loan scheme last week that was supposed to be fully operational by Monday, where businesses could go to their local bank and ask for temporary loans, if you like. But we've heard problems in the delivery of that, and that many people are being turned away because the banks don't know enough about it yet. Or worse, the banks are actually asking for specific guarantees from particular businesses, which undermines the point of the scheme, in my view, given that the government's actually underwriting 80% of the cost of these loans. They're also, as I understand it, intended to be on commercial terms. So although there's a 12-month interest-free period, beyond that, I understand the rates of interest can be very different depending on what kind of business you are. And that's even if you're lucky enough to qualify for one of those loans in the first place. There are also a lot of businesses who can't afford to take on loans. So that's the large part of the government support package. But when you're a small business and you're up to your eyes in debt and you don't know how long this uncertainty is going to last, you can't afford to take out a long-term bank loan. And I've been repeatedly calling, as have colleagues, for an extension in the government's grant system so that businesses can afford to have that temporary direct cash supply to tide them over, to keep them going. Now, the other issue that we've had a lot of queries about is about which workers should go to work. And this is a point that makes me extremely angry because it is a matter of life or death. Now, the government outlined, Boris Johnson did his big press conference and announcement to the nation where he told us all to stay at home and only go out if we needed to go shopping or to care for a vulnerable relative. But then the government's guidance that sat alongside this stated that if you couldn't work from home, then essentially you had to go to work, unless you were in one of those exempted sectors such as retail or leisure, where they'd been ordered to close down. So we've had numerous reports of employees right across the constituency and across the whole country being forced to go to work in conditions where they're not 2 metres apart, in conditions where it's not an essential industry, not something that's vital to keep us going throughout this crisis. So again, myself and other colleagues have been repeatedly asking government to state very clearly what essential work is, because those workers are being put at risk now, and we should be limiting the people who do leave their homes to try and stop the spread of this virus.
So I'd like those employees at Sports Direct who were told that they should, that their work somehow constituted essential work and they had to travel in and put themselves at risk.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that's disgraceful. But that's just one example, unfortunately. I mean, we've seen on the news reports about construction sites all up and down the country. We know that warehouses that don't deliver the essential items such as food and goods that you need in your house at this time, the more luxury goods like DIY things, wallpaper, clothing, those workers are being asked to go into those warehouses and continue business as usual. And they're not being given protection equipment, and it's not acceptable in my view, and it needs to stop.
So ideally, would you want to see an end to, for example, sort of non-essential construction at this time?
Yeah, no work that is not of a critical function at this time should be carried out. And of course, critical work has numerous forms. If it's keeping us safe, if it's our public services, if it's food workers and supermarket workers and delivery drivers, of course, that's essential at this time. But if it's not an essential function, those workers shouldn't be forced to go to work.
Mm-hmm. And you've been quite clear, I think, from the beginning of this crisis about the kind of policies that you would want to see brought in. You mentioned a universal basic income. Mm-hmm. And earlier this week on Monday, I think you mentioned how you'd like to see a national food service. So you want the government to coordinate the delivery of sort of essential supplies and food delivered by Royal Mail. And then the following day, Matt Hancock came out and announced this NHS Volunteers programme, which I think just over 500,000 people have now signed up to. I was wondering, do you think that that sort of scheme is the right way of tackling the challenge of ensuring vulnerable people get supplies and that supermarket supply chains aren't overloaded, that sort of voluntary approach?
I think the government needs to step up and coordinate. And unfortunately, what we're seeing at the moment is a lot of mutual aid groups, which are fantastic. It's communities coming together to provide support for people who are in need. But the government doesn't appear to be providing much support to those groups. So, for example, in Salford, you know, weeks ago, we recognised that there was a huge issue and that many people across the city were going to need help getting medicine supplies, they were going to need food to be delivered, whether they were vulnerable or not, and if they had to self-isolate, they'd struggle to get out to shops. So we built a bank of volunteers. And we have hundreds of them, and many of them have got DBS checks, which is quite handy, which means that they can help, you know, even driving care workers around who can't use public transport and things like that. But the government did need to step up, and, you know, now is not the time for recriminations and for raking over what they should and shouldn't have done. We need to very, very quickly now move towards having a national plan so that areas that don't have the level of organisation that we've got in Salford don't get left behind. And that's what I meant when I talked about the National Food Service. So we know that people are really concerned when they go to the supermarket, they're seeing bare shelves. and people shouldn't panic buy, but this goes way beyond panic buying, and it goes right to the essence of whether people feel reassured enough that we have food security.
Yeah, and there is new research, I think, today to suggest that actually the vast majority of people, something like 95%, aren't really panic buying. They're just, they know that they can't go out to eat anymore, and they're trying to stay in for at least a week at a time, so they're doing bigger shops and just buying slightly more. So it isn't so much a panic buying, it's just the change in the situation for people.
Exactly, that's 100% right. And children are schooled at home, and they're not having school dinners in schools. So there's definitely an extra pressure on the household fridge at this time, and that's why the government does need to make sure that we have those vital food supplies in place, and they can use the vacant leisure space that's been closed down, they can use the cinemas that and the other public spaces that they're not using anymore as storage facilities. But in terms of delivering that food, we want to keep people in homes, and we know that people who've tried to get online deliveries, the supermarkets have been overwhelmed and they're not able to cope with the levels of demand. So we've got to have additional support, and that comes through using places such as Royal Mail. The trade union that sits alongside them, the CWU, has already talked to me about the National Food Service and about their members being willing to be involved in those essential food deliveries to people's homes. And of course, we can tie into the mutual aid groups as well, where they have volunteers who've identified as people who are quite happy to deliver things.
But basically, this would require government oversight, because I suppose from a personal perspective, looking at how this volunteer service would work, most people haven't had their identities verified on that or anything. And so it's going to take a while to put into place. But it does sort of depend on, I think, local people using their initiative a little bit. And maybe, I don't know, would you argue that you'd need a bit more government oversight to make sure that this is properly coordinated?
Definitely. That's what should be happening. And what we're seeing happen is that mutual aid groups are coming together in absence of that government direction. We're trying to sort things out ourselves, and that shouldn't be the case. Of course, it's great to have brilliant people who are willing to do that, but there needs to be a level of national coordination to make sure that the food gets to these groups and these volunteers so that they can deliver it. And you're spot on about making sure that the people who are going out to people's homes are okay, that they've been checked, that they're not posing any risk to people.
Yeah. More broadly, we had Lisa and Andy on the podcast last week, and so I'm going to ask you the same question I asked her. You've kind of already given a hint of it from your last answer and so on, but if you were Prime Minister at the moment during this time of crisis, what would your leadership look like?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not Prime Minister in this crisis. And my focus at the moment has been to try and collaborate with the government as much as we can, because we want them to get this right. And although it would be easy for me to go off on a rant about what they haven't done and how I've disagreed with their strategy so far, and I haven't been happy with the way that this has been handled at all, I think now is the time to make sure that the government does take that urgent action. So they take the action on essential work that I set out before, that they make a clear package available to the self-employed today, so that the self-employed aren't worried sick about whether they're going to be able to make it to next month or not, that they're making sure that the most vulnerable in society have enough money and enough provisions to see them through this crisis, that they're making sure that the same support that they've afforded to those with mortgages is afforded to those who are renting, so that they don't have to worry about making it through this crisis. And then looking at utility bills, I've repeatedly called for a moratorium on utility bills so that people who are struggling due to coronavirus don't have to worry about whether they can afford to pay their water or electricity bill or not.
So you're quite focused on sort of applying very specific policy pressure at this time, which is interesting, because I think that it's something that we talk about in the New Statesman newsroom, and that I imagine that you're thinking a lot about as a party, as well as a leadership campaign, this idea of trying to be a responsible opposition at the moment. What kinds of conversations or discussions have you had to think about how you get this right, that you don't do any sort of political point scoring, that you're a constructive opposition at the moment?
Well, I think I've always liked to think of myself as a pragmatic politician anyway. I've not been one for ranting. I do sometimes, obviously. But I think particularly at this time, we've got to recognise that we don't have a majority in Parliament, but we have so many vulnerable people within our communities who are really going to suffer. And the crisis itself has exposed the fundamental flaws that have been in our economy for many, many years. It's shown that it doesn't matter what your profession or job is, how much money you earn, you are fragile and you're one paycheck away from absolute destitution. And we've got to make sure that as an opposition, not only do we make sure that people have the security that they need in this crisis and that their safety is number one priority, but it's when we come out of this crisis that we don't have an economy that sees anybody put in this position again. And that means completely rebuilding the foundations of the economy. It means the support that we afford to huge industries across the UK, which is the right thing to do. It comes with conditions, conditions to pay and treat the workforce well, to involve trade unions. If we do hand out large sums of money, we expect to see an equity stake so that money goes back to the public purse and can be used to better the lives of people in our communities. And it also means looking at alternatives to universal credit, such as universal basic income, so that whatever happens to anybody in their life, they will have that fundamental basis to have a decent quality of life, whatever happens.
So universal basic income is obviously quite a popular idea in some parts of the left, and then it's quite politically divisive for other parts of society, or for people elsewhere on the political spectrum, that they just don't approve of that level of state support, basically. How do you convince people that that's necessary? Do you think that this crisis might shift the consensus on that a little bit? Is that what you're hoping for?
I think this crisis has shown very, very clearly how fragile everybody is and how difficult it is to move support at speed to make sure that people have enough to live on to sustain themselves going forward. And if this is a prolonged crisis, we know that the economy is going to take a huge hit. So it's not the case that as soon as we all go back to work, everything's going to be fine again. It won't be economically. And unfortunately, despite the government support that's been offered, and even if they do extend the support to the levels that we want them to, there will be businesses that go under. There will be people who lose their jobs, and they are going to need to be looked after. And that's why we really do need to start ramping up the arguments, in my view, for a universal basic income. And the common argument is often that, you know, well, if there was a universal basic income, nobody would want to go to work. And
yeah,
that's not
it,
true.
Basically.
Because
yeah.
We've got a social security system at the moment that, you know, it doesn't say, oh, well, if you can't be bothered going to work, don't go to work and you can have benefits. It's incredibly difficult to navigate your way through that social security system. And most people who aren't in work are absolutely destitute. Whereas a universal basic income would provide that kind of minimum income floor so that everyone would have the basics, they'd have enough to sustain themselves. And then if they were in work, of course, their employer would top that up. So there would still be incentives, as there are now in the workplace, to work hard, to do well, to want to earn more money. That mm-hmm. certainly wouldn't change. It's just the way that our benefits system was structured would change to a more streamlined, easier method of delivery.
So that's interesting, because I think that sometimes this idea gets a bit confused. And when people speak about universal basic income, they have this idea that you could very happily live off that income and that then you could spend your time. Maybe this has been completely misrepresented, but I know people in France, when this was being floated during the presidential election, they had this idea that, you know, you'd have all the income that you needed and you'd be free to pursue creative, not-for-profit projects, and that the economy would be really radically structured differently, with people not incentivized to have to work anymore, but just to pursue things that, you know, to pursue projects that genuinely fulfill them. But that isn't your argument.
Well, that would be lovely if we could do that. But yeah, everybody needs, you know, if you can work, we need people to go to work. Otherwise, we won't have the things to do those nice things with. Somebody needs to make them. So So we certainly need to have a world of work, and the incentivisation would be there. And I don't think there's many people across the country who wouldn't want to do well. They wouldn't want to work hard and do useful things that contribute to society and make them feel good as a human being. We all want to do that. We all want to enjoy our jobs, and two, have a job that improves the quality of their life. So they can aspire, they can want to live in a nice house and have a car and go on holiday. And that doesn't, you know, it's not impeded at all by a universal basic income.
So it's more just really just a way of simplifying the benefit system and providing a very secure safety net for people.
Exactly. Provided that the amount that you have in that universal basic income is enough for people to actually exist and have a decent quality of life.
If I may, I'd sort of moving away from coronavirus response and economic policy, I just wanted to speak a little bit about the Labour leadership contest, just because we're coming to the end of it. As you'll be aware, because it feels like it's gone on for quite a while.
I know.
I was just wondering, so I get the impression from some other interviews that you've done that you've maybe been a bit disappointed by the quality of the debate in the contest. Is that fair enough?
It's not been very detailed. I mean, I get quite excited about policy detail and really getting into the depths of what each of the candidates believes in, because I think that's helpful for our members to understand where we're all coming from politically. And it's been good that we've had a good-natured contest and that we all get on with each other. That's a good sign for the future, I think. But that we really haven't been able to show the members how we differ politically, and we do, you know, there are many things that we agree on, but there are certainly many things that I think we would disagree on.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. What would you have liked to talk more about if you'd had the chance?
I think economic policy, because everything goes down to the way we structure our economy. And the way we structure our economy, it's not enough to say, well, oh, of course, you know, we want everybody to be better off and to have a nice life. We've got to talk about how we deliver that. And the way we deliver that could differ in many ways. And that would shine a light on our political outlook. So I'm, you know, we already know I'm a strong advocate of universal basic income. I very strongly favour public ownership of key utilities in order to use that as a vehicle for further investment in the economy, but also to ensure that that public nature of that organisation can be used to go back to the community and to invest in people. I also believe very strongly in a green industrial revolution, and I don't think it's enough to simply tinker around the edges. I think you need a fundamental and comprehensive programme that many people politically might not agree with, you know, when I talk about taking the energy network companies into public ownership, for example. Many on the left wouldn't agree with that, but I think that that was a necessary thing to do in order to drive forward the change that we needed to see as quickly as possible.
So you would have liked to dive into the weeds of those policies a bit more, and I feel like what you're implying is that you would have liked journalists to push Lisa and Andy and Keir Starmer more on questions like public ownership to see where the three of you differ a bit more.
I think that, yeah, it certainly would have been helpful, because the people's perceptions of public ownership differ. And, you know, talking about common ownership, if that's just, you know, a few kind of nice community initiatives to put solar panels on roofs, that's not my view of public ownership, which is more large scale and has more of an industrial driving presence in the economy.
Okay, I see. Also, sort of on that, a lot of our listeners are very politically engaged. A lot of them are Labour Party members, and lots of others are Labour Party supporters. So lots of them will have already voted in the contest or will be saving their vote. But I think lots of people have already cast theirs by now, probably. I was wondering, I think there might be some people looking at the contest who think, well, I share a lot of Rebecca Long Bailey's socialist values, but there's been a lot of infighting in the Labour Party over the past few years, and they associate that with Jeremy Corbyn, and they think, I don't think she's the candidate for me because I want an end to the infighting, and I don't think that she's the person to deliver that. What's your message for those kinds of people? Because I think there could be people like that in our listenership and in our readership.
I mean, I think most Labour Party members have been going through what I can only describe as a grieving process over the last few months since the general election. And on election night, it was as if everything that we believed in and we'd worked towards was invalidated in one fell swoop. We were told we can't really have that because people don't want it. And people questioned whether they needed to change, whether they should believe in these things. And why I stood was because I was trying to tell them very clearly that it wasn't what we believed in that was wrong. Yes, there was a lot we got wrong in that election campaign, all the way through from the way we handled Brexit through to many of the issues that had lost trust with our voters. We didn't have a campaign that had an overarching message that resonated with people in the way that the Conservatives did. And certainly the way we packaged our campaign, bringing out numerous policies instead of just concentrating on the key ones and marketing them in the best way possible, wasn't helpful. But on the question of unity, for nearly 5 years, we were a disunited party, and we can't go through that again. And anybody in the party who thinks that to let one element of the party take over will see this go away is very naive. We have to move forward now, and we've got to recognise that the only way we're ever going to win a general election is by bringing all the different elements of the party together. And it's actually really positive to have different groups within the party. It's not positive to fight each other. It's not positive to have MPs or members saying things publicly to the media about the elected leader of the party or indeed each other. It undermines everything we're trying to do. But if we can have those policy discussions in private, and then once we've agreed those positions, then we'll come out stronger and we all should unify behind the leader. And that's certainly what I'll do. If I don't win this leadership contest, whoever wins, I might not agree with them all of the time and I might tell them that privately. But as far as the general public's concerned, I'll be behind them 101%. And that's what every single Labour Party member generally does.
So you would commit to keeping those differences and those policy debates private?
Definitely. And I think it's healthy to have those debates, but not to do it publicly, because mm-hmm. we've seen how destructive that's been. Because why would anybody vote for a party where the MPs in that party won't even support the elected leader? It's absurd.
It's been striking, I think, watching it as a political journalist over the past few weeks. I feel like the Labour Party's response to coronavirus has been very slick and very well coordinated, in that I think you've broadly spoken as one voice on the need to improve sick pay. You've been putting pressure on with regards to the measures for the self-employed that will be coming out later today at the point of recording. And Lisa and Andy mentioned on the podcast last week that there had been a sort of discussion with Jeremy Corbyn and you and Keir Starmer and John McDonnell and her to think about how you could do this constructively. And mm-hmm. it seems to be working. And I'm wondering, do you think it's fair to say that the Labour Party is more united as a result of having to come together for this crisis, more united than it's been for a long time?
Definitely, because we know that the lives of our constituents are at stake, and any Labour MP would move heaven and earth to make sure that people they represent are looked after and that they're safe. But I also think that there's been a really good level of collaboration across the party on this issue, and we've all been working very productively with each other. And even prior to this crisis, I think a lot of members and even our own MPs took heart in the way that the leadership campaign was being conducted, because the candidates have generally been very nice to each other and very cooperative, and it set out very firm foundations for the future, whoever wins this really, and long may it continue. Fingers crossed that it will.
That's a good note to end on. I just have one final question. So last week, when I was speaking to Lisa and Andy, I asked, just by asking her how her family is doing. And those of us who've been following the Labour leadership contest closely know that you refer to your four-year-old son as the king.
yeah.
So I was just wondering, how's the king doing, and how are your family coping with this strange time?
Yeah, the king's fine. He's gone through like the novel period now, because this is Thursday. So this is day four of homeschooling. So it's all really mm-hmm. exciting for him. So we've been getting up and doing the 9 o'clock Joe Wicks PE lesson.
Oh, you've been doing
every day.
It.
Oh, very yeah, good. It's really good. It's quite tiring though for the grown ups. And then we've been trying to figure out his lessons, and me and the husband have been doing shifts. You know, mm-hmm. do a bit of work and then the other one's doing the lessons. So we're all doing all right so far.
Okay, great. Rebecca Long-Bailey, thank you very much for joining us on the New Statesman
Thanks
podcast.
Thanks a lot. You look after yourself.
And now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us.
You Ask Us. Cuckoo!
The question of the hour is, I'm scrolling furiously up through the long list of questions, is, I guess broadly, God, there are so many on this theme, but essentially the broad question is, you know, unity government, what's that about, A?
Can I read one of them out? Because I thought it was asked in a very good way. This is a question from Rishi, brackets, not Sunak. Why do people think there might be a national unity government when the Tories have a pretty substantial majority?
Was really a good place to start. Obviously, this is a conversation that's been had with varying degrees of seriousness among Tory MPs in private. But for an indication of whether it's going to happen, and obviously I caveat this preemptively by saying we're very early in this crisis. We don't know where it's going to end up. We don't know what Keir Starmer is going to say to an impatient public via Zoom on the 4th of April. But for a mark of sort of where I think, how serious I think this discussion is, how likely it's going to happen, I think it's quite telling that the only Conservative MP to have gone on the record about this, and maybe Stephen, actually, you'll have had conversations with, you've had conversations with cabinet ministers about this very idea, but I just sort of think any idea that starts life as a kite flown by George Freeman, the self-regarding sort of intellectual of the Tories, MP from Mid Norfolk, hosts the so-called Tory Glastonbury, the Big Tent Ideas Festival. Great guy, but by all accounts, has a reputation as a bit of a sort of chin-scratching eccentric among some of his colleagues. So I sort of read, oh wow, a Tory MP and a former minister has gone on the record to talk about a government of national unity. You scroll down to the sixth part of the Guardian story and you see George Freeman. Okay. But I think it's certainly been talked to, it's been talked about among colleagues. But yeah, maybe when Keir Starmer is Deputy Prime Minister in 4 weeks' time, I'll regret this segment. But I am quite bearish on it.
Well, I guess, so on the specific historical point about the size of the majority, right? The government's majority is smaller than the Conservative majority in 1940, when they went into a coalition with the Labour Party. It's obviously considerably bigger than in the Liberal majority in 1916, when they went into coalition with the Conservatives primarily, but also some Labour MPs, and also some Liberal MPs were involved in the coalition in 1940. I would broadly agree with Patrick that up until the point that the people talking about it on the record are figures in the heart of the party, then it becomes a bit abstract. But it's all basically right. The reason why people are talking about it is this might go on for a very long time, and the measures may be very unpopular, slash, in order for MPs who are worried about the civil liberties implications on the Tory side to feel relaxed about it, they feel that you need to bake in from the very beginning the idea that when you do things like what we are currently embarked upon, you don't do them with one party alone.
Yeah, and also one would much rather Keir Starmer, a very effective opposition politician, and also a guy that believes very sincerely in civil liberties and has spent his entire career thinking very deeply about the legislative framework for and the deeper moral questions around interactions between institutions of the state that exercise power, i.e. most notably the police. He spent much of his early days as a barrister. God, I'm going to get so much content out of this profile on this podcast. But, you know, acting against the police and thinking deeply about questions of state power, and also who we know is a very effective forensic, loyally, if you will, opposition politician at the dispatch box. As much as some very online people on the soft left think he has been sluggish and not out there enough with his response to this thing, if you're a Tory, there's a reason, as you say, Stephen, that people are talking about this. And if you can put it a little bit more bluntly, it's like, would you rather Keir Starmer at the dispatch box opposite you, or with his hands on the tiller with Boris Johnson? I think, you know, any sensible Tory would pick the latter.
Yeah, I have to admit, I've not had many conversations about this because I've been working on different stories. But that was my big question about this idea is, surely, first of all, what's the mechanism for doing it? Would it have to be, you know, Boris Johnson as an individual reaching his hand out towards Keir Starmer? Or is there some kind of way that Parliament can vote for a national government? How does it work? And second of all, surely if it reaches the point where they want to sort of have Labour's fingerprint on their coronavirus response. Does that mean that they've lost confidence in their response, or does it mean that they're worried about the trust that the government, the trust that the public has in their response, or the their popularity begins falling? So they think, okay, we've got to implicate the opposition in this too.
Because one of the reasons why, you know, since I first sort of spoke to people about it, I think the chances of it have gone down, isn't the argument about how it would happen is, yeah, you basically have Boris Johnson does a kind of, I can't remember where David Cameron made his big open and comprehensive offer to the Liberal Democrats from. But, you know, when he basically went on air and went, I'm making a big offer to the Liberal Democrats, essentially Boris Johnson would do something like that. But I think one of the reasons why that's become so unlikely now, and I just want to stress test this with everyone here, is that I think the government has got itself into a real mess in making it seem like this will be a thing that will go away quickly for sure. And then it's now just so painful for them to turn around and go, by the way, we now think this might go on for several years, therefore we would like... I basically take the view that if you can't write the speech in which someone would deliver and look at it and go, yeah, that's a plausible speech, then it probably won't happen. And I can no longer conceive of a moment in which Boris Johnson can stand up and go, I know I somehow allowed myself to say 12 weeks, but maybe it'll be more like 2 years. I just don't see how that moment can happen in a way that is not politically so destructive that it won't happen. But I'm intrigued at what others think.
I totally agree with that, Stephen.
Yeah, I mean, I agree.
I had a slightly grim thought the other day that I think we might well look back, or history might look back on Boris Johnson's throwaway 12-week comment as one of those horrible phrases, like as similar to one of those terrible phrases at the beginning of the First World War about, you know, you'll be home before the leaves are falling from the trees, or you'll be home for Christmas. I think it was such a, from a political perspective, just such an error to put a time frame on it when he really can't deliver that.
Also, he expectantly, that sort of viral FT story that was doing the rounds yesterday about sort of have we all had coronavirus already, about that Oxford University study. Listening to him at the, it was at the press conference yesterday, him saying to Patrick Vallance, hey, what about this story that says half of everybody has got it already? He said sort of expectantly, almost expecting him to say, oh yeah, no, we have, it's fine. Everything's back to normal now, Boris. To read the Times leader comparing him to Neville Chamberlain, if the consensus grows in the Conservative Party that the government, which the government isn't listening, Johnson hasn't been communicating with sufficient clarity, decisions have been taken too slowly. If Keir Starmer does say, yes, I'm up for a national government, surely there's an argument that he might be the one to impose conditions, not the Conservative Party. He might say, yes, I'll be Rishi Sunak's deputy prime minister, or yes, I will, I will prop up Rishi Sunak. But, and I think there might, you know, as this, if this continues for much longer, and Boris Johnson is seen to have made misjudgments with very grave consequences, then actually the power dynamic could shift there, I think, perhaps.
Yeah, I agree. That bit in the press conference was bizarre, wasn't it? It was sort of like...
Yeah, tell me it's going to be fine. It wasn't very much like, I read this in the paper, or someone sent me this on WhatsApp.
Yeah, I know, it's really strange. It's like, you're the Prime Minister. But I do think, because at the moment he's got better approval ratings than before. But like you say, I think once that 12 weeks... And it's such a seductive thing, isn't it? Like, in my head... psychologically, I think this is going to be over in 12 weeks because Boris Johnson said it, which is ridiculous because I'm a journalist who has been covering Boris Johnson's leadership for some time and his measures that he put in place in previous positions. But I think when it becomes clear that that was just him projecting his optimism onto the nation, I think that his approval ratings could slip quite quickly.
Yeah, I think it's just like, well, as Alva says, right, it's just like, don't make promises you not only that you can't keep, but that you, if you have to break them, what is your justification for breaking it? Your justification for breaking it is, I said this thing, it was witless and I shouldn't have said it. I mean, I do also think, yeah, now this is kind of thing where I'm going to slightly cheat here and blame the government twice. And then I think it is partially, of course, the questions that were being asked pushed him in that direction. But the government has chosen to treat COVID like it's fighting the Labour Party. I don't mean as in how they're acting towards the Labour Party, but, you know, like the evening briefings, the stuff to sympathetic journalists. It's just like, guys, this isn't about, like, you know, you don't need to draw dividing lines with COVID so you can, like, have them pay off at the election. Like, you just need to be to lay out plainly what the challenges are. And that does encourage journalists to ask questions that call for an unhelpful level of certainty. And I do now think, you know, these tests, which are being presented as if they will mean we can all, you know, feel the sun on our skin, the 12-week limit. I just think it's a catastrophic mistake. So, yeah, no, I think Albert's point about World War One is very well made.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekellian, and my colleagues Stephen Bush, Alva Ray, and Patrick Maguire. If you want to ask a question for You Ask Us, we now have a contact form which we'll be tweeting out. We're produced by Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.